discussion. Okay.
Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's April 10, 2017. We're going to start off with Senate Bill 1044, so we'll open a public hearing on that. And Patrick, come on up, Steve.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1044. I wrote a long SMS on this one, Mr. Chair. I'd hate to steal Steve's thunder on this, so maybe I'll just dispense with the saying that this is OLCC's bill that makes a lot of technical changes and let him go with it, Mr. Chair. I can tell you that we are expecting an amendment for this bill, and so we'll not be moving it today, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you getting us up promptly. We're trying to head north up to Washington this afternoon, so to meet with other regulators of actually marijuana. 1044 is really a customer service and sort of efficiency bill for OLCC. What it primarily does is removes the old barrier at point of sale and gets us away from using a single register, separate register from the retail business, and allows the business, retail business, to accept cash and then use normal banking processes to transfer with an ACH transfer within 48 hours. This is really necessary as we have started retail expansion. And, you know, liquor's becoming one item amongst other retail items in these outlets that we have. Even amongst our traditional liquor store outlets, they're doing beer and wine, and we're separating that with our separate cash register. We've worked this out with Treasury. They prefer that we amend our own statutes and public funds to accomplish the same. And so we needed this bill to achieve that. Requires us to hold daily, at least the remittance of one equivalent to one a day of daily sales from the business as a deposit, so that then they could use their normal banking practices instead of going through a state account. This gets us away, or allows us to actually commingle funds technically. When you sell a bottle of liquor that's state property, that funds is immediately state property or immediately public funds on transfer. So it allows us to deal with a retail experience like every other business does, right? The cash would go into the normal business accounts that would make prompt transfer to us through ACH within 48 hours. So that's a very good efficiency for the system, and I think something that recognizes the modernization that we've been going through. This bill does some other fixes for OLCC. It removes some barriers to online service permit application systems. It really, some of the things that we identified that would be barriers to getting online that were in statute or were asking to be removed, like the requirement for a physical signature. So we want that to go away so we can actually do electronic verification of the person online. So it has some efficiencies in that when they're online, they won't have duplicate fees because they'll be able to print out their permit at any time. If they lost it or otherwise, it would still be valid. Changes the renewal from 5 years to the date of issuance, which will be easy to do with an electronic system. So there are efficiency gains there. It cleans up the law with relation to distillery retail outlets, which are operated much like our stores, right? They can make sales. We have contracts with them. We need to affirm the ability to contract with them. So this language puts that in place. We have treated them like contract agents, and the law is less clear about that, so we thought it was time to make sure that in law we were covered with doing contracts instead of licensing for them. When you exit OLCC and you are not in compliance, we have sanctions against you. We currently terminate with a letter. This change in this bill would allow us to contemplate some recovery of fees if that person ever came back into our system. So this is helpful in that regard. I've been perturbed that we send out these letters to no effect when bad licensees leave the system. So this gives us some ability to think about what kind of reentry penalty you might have. And then the Dash 1 amendments actually creates a little additional tool for us to require to have the ability to require mandatory education as a sanction. And we find this is going to be helpful not only on the marijuana side, but also on the alcohol side. So those are the changes. It's cleanup primarily, but that point of sale changes and the public fund changes, a significant one. And thank you for your consideration.
So when you have another one pending to put an emergency clause on?
We are working at getting the emergency clause put into the amendment. I don't know if it's the Dash 1, a change to the Dash 1 or
separate. Dash 2. But
yeah,
you might,
Dash 2.
Might have them folded into the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Questions?
Question.
Senator?
Yeah, Steve, these little boutique tasting room for some of the products that we're producing now in these little boutique distilleries, how do you maintain security? I know how you secure the liquor stores. I'm, you know, always impressed with how tight they are and the fact that it'd be almost impossible other than to break in with a gun to rob the place or to pilfer some of it. But how do you protect the security in these little boutique tasting rooms that are cropping up now in some of these little special distilleries?
So I'll take a crack at this, and then Jesse can correct me or provide some more technical detail. But we use the same contracting. We have the same provisions we put in place for our retail outlets. So it's part of the standard contract on the security requirements that we would require of that business.
Reminds me of something.
Jesse, you have an add to that?
For the record, Jesse Sweet with OLCC. I think Steve has essentially said it. It's done by contract. These tasting rooms submit control plans to OLCC staff. OLCC staff work with the agents to make sure that their control plan is appropriate. We're primarily focused at these locations on access to minors and public safety issues around consumption. Because they don't hold large amounts of inventory, there's less concern about robberies and things of that nature.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is something that is relatively new in the liquor business in this state, and I know that by the action that we've taken or not taken, we have protected these small boutique distilleries, mm-hmm. And they can actually market their product in our state. And one of the things we allow them to do is to have these little tasting rooms like a wine tasting room. I just wanted to make sure that we're making sure that we're not getting minors having access to that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Any others?
Pear liqueur is still
tasting nasty.
Jesse, being here reminded me of something. Last session we were talking about making sure that some of these home brewers were providing their product as a gift to fundraisers and kind of these charitable things. And you talked about being able to fix that. Have we fixed that?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I believe you're referring to a provision which would allow home brewers to sell their products at auction for charitable purposes.
Yeah, at charities.
Yeah. So that would need a statutory change, and I have not seen that bill.
So how would you, since you're doing an amendment, how would you like to, this is a wonderful relating clause, how would you like to fix that?
I can provide you some text to fix that.
Could you just add that into your amendment? That'd be wonderful. Thank you, Jesse. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, apparently you have us over a barrel on that one.
They're only bottles. They're not barrels.
I just did want to say this is important for retail expansion. As Senator Monroe knows, he sat through our budget hearings. We are looking to gain 3% revenue growth within the current biennium. We've expanded 20 stores in the current biennium, next biennium. In the current biennium, we've expanded by 20 outlets. We expect to add about 43 new outlets in the next biennium. I think that puts us around 310, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, that's not a hard target because we're in a new process. We're allowing people to make proposals to come forward. They compete within a geographic area. The commission then appoints them in that competition. So some of them are not, you know, of the same size. Some are smaller. Some are larger. So we'll look to be mindful of citing the proper stores for convenience and also to keep track of revenue growth along the way.
As I recall from looking at that last time we had it in during the interim, that still would leave us population ratio-wise under where we were 20 years ago.
Yes, we would still be under.
Okay.
And Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You very much.
Thank you.
Yes, but, Senator.
And Mr. Chair, since the Washington privatized, we have tens of thousands of Washingtonians coming to Oregon to buy their booze. And, of course, our state is doing very well based on that. And liquor stores, especially those near the Washington border, are just reaping a big benefit from that. I know I talked to the chair of the subcommittee, which is Senator Johnson, who lives in Scappoose, and she says the liquor stores there near the bridge are just flooded with Washington license plates.
And the co-chairs of Ways and Means are very excited about that.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1044? Seeing none, we will close on that, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 986. Patrick.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just grab that. There we go. All right. So, Senate Bill 986 permits insurance licensees to not provide annual notices to licensees' policies and practices with respect to disclosing personal information if the licensee provides such information to non-affiliated third parties only in accordance with applicable law and does not change policies and practices that the licensee last disclosed to the customer. This measure has no amendments. It comes to us with a statement of no fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing the American Insurance Association. And on OLIS there is a joint letter from the American Insurance Association, the Property Casualty Insurance Association, National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, and I believe the American Council of Life Insurers in support of this bill. It's coming to you because federal law used to require privacy notices. You've all seen them when you get your annual renewal for your credit card or your or any number of other banking or insurance products. Federal law has changed, and now federal law requires that those privacy notices come when you open an account and or when the privacy policy changes. We have gone to insurance commissioners in various states and asked that state rules be updated, and our insurance commissioner was really quite accepting of that and then came back and said, oops, we have a little problem. We have a statutory requirement that doesn't allow us to change it by rule. And so this is a bill that we worked with them to make sure it did exactly what that was, which is to allow them to conform to federal law, which means those privacy notices on insurance policies will come when the policy is entered into and or when the privacy policy of the insurer changes, and you won't get those annual inserts with your renewal bill. I believe the bill has no opposition. I've certainly heard none, and ask and hope you will pass it to the floor with due pass, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Paul? I see none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody from DCBS here? As this week.
As a matter of fact, there is, Mr. Chair.
Any concerns?
Nope. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager, DFR. We actually had, be less flippant, we actually had started looking at drafting a bulletin that clarified that the FAST Act, which is the federal law that this is based on, would allow this kind of the activity that's required by the bill. We ran into a statutory issue, and so this has been fixed, or it is proposed to be fixed.
Okay. Anybody?
I say move it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 986? Don't see any, so we will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 986.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 986 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson's moved Senate Bill 986 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 986 goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry that?
Well, I think the vice chair is really a good one to carry.
Senator Girard will carry this bill. Close on that.
Yeah, the chairman takes care of me.
Okay. So just an announcement very quickly here. The staff has told me Senate Bill 1049 has been withdrawn by the sponsor. And Senate Bill 538 is carried over to the Wednesday, April 12th meeting, so we won't be talking about that today, okay? And there, so where should we go next? I thought I sent a representative here.
So.
Stand at ease for just a moment. He was here a minute ago.
What's a bill? Which
one? I don't know which one he was here on. That's it. I'm just trying to show standard legislative courtesy.
Oh, who's here?
Popped in and popped out when I wasn't looking. And I lost my staff, so I'm not sure where to go from here. Actually, I think we're waiting on Senator Roblin.
And that's what we're waiting for on 315. Huh? That is what we're waiting for. It's supposed to be next door.
We're waiting on another senator.
At time of the session. Come on, Patrick. Where's the script here? What's next?
Run 1051.
Are we doing Senate 313? We need to vote
with
1051.
Okay.
You do?
We're open to public hearing on Senate Bill 313. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 313
subsequent ways and means
directs the arts program of the Oregon Business Development Department to conduct a study on issues related to outcomes of arts education. We have in hand a Dash 2 amendment, which we just received this morning, which maybe the people here to speak to did not know about.
They don't. Obviously, they don't know about it.
Dash 2 amendment replaces the original measure and creates a task force on equitable access to arts education. Okay, I'm good. That's a good sign, yes. So that task force would sunset June 30th, 2019, and take effect on the 91st day following a German signee die. But like I said, having just received that this morning, we do not yet have fiscal or revenue statements on that, Mr. Chair.
Is there a referral?
Mr. Campbell and your panel, come on up and tell us what you did.
You have a task force.
Yeah, it has one. I just forgot to say it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Commission in support of what we think is the Dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 313. We were waiting to get it from the legislator, and I failed to do my job in watching the postings on OLS to see if it was posted there. So in the great faith that the amendments that are before you are the ones that we are seeking, I will proceed accordingly. I know it comes as a great shock that the underlying bill asks for a study, and somehow that wasn't the real intention of the bill, and we're substituting with other language. And As is often the case, you'll be relieved to hear that you will not have to rely upon my knowledge of this bill in order to have faith that it should be moved forward. With that, the Cultural Advocacy Coalition advocates on behalf of 1,400 arts, heritage, and humanities cultural nonprofits throughout the state. The coalition's membership includes individuals, businesses, and cultural organizations throughout the state who are committed to supporting public investment and policies to ensure that all Oregonians have the opportunity to access high-quality arts, history, and humanities in their communities. The bill that you have before you is going to create a blue ribbon panel. Now, access to quality arts education is central to a well-rounded education, which raises graduation rates, lowers absenteeism, bolsters test scores, and improves educational outcome for low-income and marginalized students. The arts is a subject that is part of the Oregon core curriculum statutes, and now the arts are embedded in the Every Student Succeeds Act's shift from a tight focus on assessed core subjects to a well-rounded education for all students. It emphasizes the need that all students have to have access to a well-rounded education that includes the arts, humanities, sciences, social sciences, English, and mathematics. But arts content standards are not tested in Oregon, and despite substantial research showing that the benefit an arts education offers to low-income and historically marginalized student populations, the reality is that often that if a subject is not required to be tested, it is not often taught. We have policies in place to allow for the delivery of arts education, but we need more information and strong recommendations if we're going to provide the tools and supports to help all students succeed. So the Blue Ribbon Task Force proposal that you have before you will quantify existing access to arts education, will research evidence-based best practices in arts education to improve student outcomes, identify barriers to equity, and recommend structural, statutory, and systematic changes needed to achieve equitable access to the arts within the whole child education approach. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I now leave you in the good hands of those who would otherwise know what they're talking about.
So to make sure, since you haven't seen the amendment, to make sure we're talking about the same thing, it establishes a 15-member task force.
It does.
To research, evaluate, and make recommendations regarding equitable access to arts education.
That is the one.
That's
yes.
The one. Okay. Yes. We're talking about the same thing then.
I got a question.
Senator?
I've worked with lots of groups. 15 seems really large.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, your question there, your comment there is very astute. We started with a much larger group, and the key is trying to make sure that you have enough voices that meld education and arts together to actually do the work that needs to be done. And because it is so complicated dealing with merging those together, we have more folks than we would probably like, but we need to have each one of those there. But I believe me, I understand your concern with a 15-member task force.
Please.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Deb Vaughn, and I am the Arts Education Coordinator for the Oregon Arts Commission, which is part of Business Oregon. I'm currently the only full-time state employee who is tasked with promoting arts learning opportunities for all students. I manage a competitive matching grant program for nonprofit arts organizations to engage students in artistic experiences and grow their creative potential. Through these grants, the Arts Commission supports projects around the state that foster partnerships between teachers and artists to benefit kindergarten through 12th grade students. This grant represents the only ongoing statewide funding specifically designated for arts education. The Arts Commission tracks which schools benefit from these grants, but that doesn't present a comprehensive view of student access to the arts. Senate Bill 313 will help expand public information about what arts opportunities are offered and which students engage in them. But allow me to share a little bit about what we already know. The Arts Commission, beginning in 2010, worked with the State Department of Education to publish a searchable database with information about which schools offered arts classes every year. And this is a critical way for parents and other members of the public to learn about opportunities students have to participate in arts classes during school hours. What we learned from that research is that the availability of these classes varies greatly from one school to another. To expand upon that research, the Arts Commission worked with the Oregon Community Foundation last year to produce the Oregon Arts Education Snapshot. This report explored what educational programming was offered by arts organizations. The results showed that while these organizations play an important role in supporting schools, it's challenging for them to achieve long-term impacts as school personnel, leadership, and curriculum emphasis changes. This uneven access to creative experiences in schools is a critical barrier to achieving educational equity. The task force proposed in this bill will help gather even more knowledge about student access to the arts so that Oregon can help all students stay engaged in school and graduate with the skills that employers value. The national nonprofit group Americans for the Arts reports that 72% of business leaders cite creativity as the number one skill they seek when hiring. And research also shows that students who are highly engaged in the arts, low-income students who are highly engaged in the arts, are more than twice as likely to graduate college than their peers with no arts education. This bill will bring together key stakeholders to assure that Oregon students develop creativity while they're in school, which sets them up for successful futures. The bill will lay the groundwork to promote the creative best practices of schools, like the Academy of Arts and Academics in Springfield, which is one of only 18 schools in the state that offers classes in all five artistic disciplines. So that would be theater, visual art, dance, music, and media arts. You're going to hear testimony from organizations that have used arts learning grant funds from the Arts Commission to support their work in schools, like the Regional Arts and Culture Council in the Portland Tri-County area, and Arts and Education of the Gorge in Hood River, Sherman, and Wasco counties. These are just two examples of arts organizations who are working to assure that students build the creative skills necessary to become successful adults. Investments in arts education are investments in Oregon's future. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Dr. Golden.
Chairperson Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, and I live in Springfield, Oregon. I'm also a very proud member of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, and today I'm here to testify about the importance of the Task Force on Equitable Access to Art Education. From 2003 to 2013, I had the privilege of being superintendent in Springfield Public Schools. And when I was there, I looked at some data when I first arrived, and I saw a group of students who had poor attendance, poor grades, higher than usual behavioral problems, and poor graduation rate. So I brought these students together in a focus group, and I could tell by being with them for 5 minutes that art was needed to be at the center of everything they did. Just look at the doodles on their notebooks, and you could see they were incredibly artistic. The way they expressed themselves through how they dressed, they were incredibly artistic. So we created the Academy of Arts and Art and Academics. What we saw with this, it's a project-based approach to education with arts in the center. What we saw during the time I was there is that they ended up having the highest test scores in reading, language arts, and science, the highest graduation rate, and almost no behavioral problems. This started as a magnet school in Springfield, but so many kids from other districts wanted into this art-based school that we became a district-sponsored charter school. Now, I don't want to say that art is only important to kids who go to a special art school. It's important to absolutely every child. So in Springfield Public Schools, we needed to have arts in every school. And I can tell you, for the winter holiday program at Springfield High School, you had four generations come on stage to sing the Hallelujah Chorus. We could not get all the people into the room. We had to set screens up so people could see it. I always said, if you want to give a message to the community, have a performance and everybody will come and you'll have a great audience. In addition to that, our mariachi group brought different cultures together. Our visual artists were able to demonstrate their skills by actually being part of a team who painted murals in the downtown. And if you haven't been downtown Springfield, we have gorgeous murals in downtown Springfield. So what we know is that when students are involved in arts, their test scores increase. And to me, it's perfectly logical. If you've read Maxwell Gladwell's book, The Outliers, he talks about this concept of 10,000 hours. What he says is for anyone to master a skill, it takes 10,000 hours to really master it. Any of you musicians, anybody there play an instrument, sing?
Yeah, you think so.
10,000 hours is not unusual for someone to master an instrument. So through the arts, we learn grit. Through grit, we learn to really put all our effort forward, and you can see how these together lead to increased graduation. Now, you can see arts really mattered in Springfield. But like most other places, we were facing financial issues. So we came together as a group, and we created this Art Matters. It was a community group. We had nonprofit people there. We had business people there. We had community people. And together, we produced this document. I don't think the committee had more than 15 people, but it was very, very close. That's for sure. What I can tell you is we were trying to create the kind of standard, the kind of vision, the kind of pathway that we want to create with this task force. Why this is important is every district can't take the time to do this. It takes too much time. By having a statewide task force, what we'll be able to do is come up with the standards, come up with model programs, come up with the approach that we need, and I think it will save a lot of time on the part of a lot of different districts. So what we know, there's lots of opportunity now, because it was talked a little bit about, but with Every Child Succeed Act and the idea that a well-rounded education is important, a well-rounded student is important, to me what that says is it's really time to get a task force together to really show how the arts can be a key part of a child's education. So we care about arts in Oregon. We care about a well-rounded education. And this task force would be the first step in ensuring that all students have access to powerful art education programs and a well-rounded education. So I urge you to support this task force. Thank you very much.
Senator Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I was a painting major in college, so I get this. But it also is a task force, which costs money. Who's going to staff this task force? How will it be managed? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, this would be a legislatively run task force, so it would go through committee services.
What I was afraid of.
And Mr. Chair, I can now acknowledge that the Dash 2 amendments are the amendments that we have been looking for and would like to publicly thank Legislative Council for getting them done in time for today's committee.
But not quick enough to get the fiscal. All right. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair.
Oops. Senator.
Nice to see you again, Nancy. Nancy spent a lot of time in my office. We became pretty good friends.
That's true.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, I think it's Marna Stalkup and Neil DuPonte and Shelley. I can't quite make that out. You know who you are. Just my document is a little, the copy is not so good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marna Stalkup. I am the Director of Arts Education at the Regional Arts and Culture Council serving the Greater Portland Tri-County region. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 313 with amendments. With a 37-year career in arts education in the Portland metropolitan area public schools, I've witnessed the dramatic swings in support of the arts in education. Arts education, therefore, might be described as episodic, often flourishing when times are good or in well-resourced schools and communities and absent from those that are not. Or it could be dependent upon the passion of individual teachers and their comfort and their training in the arts. So I want to offer an example of a successful endeavor in the Portland Tri-County region, one that Ms. Vaughn mentioned as being funded by the Oregon Arts Commission. So in order to counter this trend that we've seen, a variety of public and private partners in the Portland region collaborated to launch the Right Brain Initiative in 2008. Partners included local government, school districts, nonprofit arts organizations, private foundations, and businesses. And most important is that the program was designed in response to school district needs and is in alignment with their priorities of equity, literacy, and student engagement. We're currently serving over 27,000 K-8 students in 68 schools across 7 school districts, including the Corbett School District and Gresham-Barlow, Portland Public Schools, and Reynolds in Multnomah County. In Clackamas County, we're serving Oregon Trail School District, the North Clackamas District, and in Washington County, the Hillsborough School District. So Right Brain is a school-wide arts integration model where it's an approach to teaching. So it's not what teachers teach, but how they teach. And it provides students the opportunity to demonstrate their understanding in any subject through an art form. So examples might be sixth graders that are learning about the water cycle and demonstrating their knowledge and understanding through dance, or third graders in developing their writing skills by crafting their own stories with puppets that they've designed. Professional development is the bedrock of the Right Brain Initiative and includes opportunities for teachers to understand the research behind arts integration, training them in the use of arts-based strategies to use in their teaching practice, and also the opportunity to share best practices peer-to-peer for school-wide implementation serving every child. Evidence of this effectiveness, of the effectiveness of this systemic and sustainable model comes from a report published in 2014, the reference earlier to test scores. This, too, was based on test scores that shows a correlation between a school's engagement in the Right Brain Initiative and student achievement. This 5-year study examined over 18,000 student records, and analysis was done on student test scores on Oregon standardized tests in reading and math that showed an average annual increase more than doubling each year. But the most significant gains were noted for English language learners, where their English proficiency scores increased at least 10 times more, with steep increases upon deeper engagement with the program. A quick case in point is a first grade classroom where 50% of the students were English language learners, and half the class recognized 3 or fewer letters of the alphabet. In a 4-session residency with a musician, the students were introduced to musical sounds as they studied the alphabet. Their teacher commented that the students were giving her the name of the letter in a beat. Instead of just B, they would rap B, 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 and even recognizing letters that had not been taught in class. A post-residency test showed that 80% of the students doubled their letter recognition, and one child jumped from identifying just 2 letters to recognizing 20. So Right Brain has gained a recognition across the state of Oregon and in the U.S. as an effective, systemic, and sustainable approach that addresses the educational opportunity gap through the arts. In closing, I'd like to share our most recent accolade that comes from the National Endowment for the Arts as a 5-time grantee recipient that supports our professional development program. A week ago, I was invited to travel to Washington, D.C., and along with 2 students from the Hillsborough School District shared the impact of the Right Brain Initiative with the National Council on the Arts. These 2 students shared a video, a stop-motion animation video they had created as part of their science unit on cell division. And it's because of that, that was a perfect example that these students were lucky to have been immersed in an arts-infused and arts-integrated learning environment since kindergarten. And that's a real testament to the power of the arts to actively engage learners as creative and critical thinkers. I'm happy to answer any questions at this time, if there are any.
Thank you. Please. Whoever wants to go next.
My next. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Neil DuPont, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I am the founder and executive artistic director of the nonprofit organization Metro Arts, Inc., which promotes using the arts to teach creative processes and critical thinking skills. I'm also the music director and conductor for Oregon Ballet Theater's orchestra and the principal percussionist of the Oregon Symphony. And I would just stop for a moment and mention that I suspect that you're all masters of your craft here, because you've probably spent 10,000 hours in committee meetings, so I think therefore you qualify. I'm here, of course, to support Senate Bill 313 with the amendments that would create a task force on equitable access to arts education. You may know that in 2015 we all entered what is now called the innovation age, when for the first time more than 50% of all human beings on earth will have access to the internet and its cloud. In the innovation age, creativity and innovation will be the skills most highly valued in
students graduating from our schools. While it is undeniable that there will be an increasing demand for skills in science, technology, engineering, and math, the STEM skills, students who excel in the skills of creativity and innovation and evidence a talent for combining various types of data and concepts into new outcomes will be the most prized workers of all. This is why we must add the letter A for art to STEM and mandate a STEAM curriculum in our state. This is the work a task force must take on, to examine how we can best use the arts to make our students more innovative, more creative, and become better problem solvers, and how to give access to that information to all students. A Rhode Island School of Design conference stated that the tools and methods of a studio-based education, one that replicates how an artist creates new work in the studio environment, offer new models for creative problem-solving, flexible thinking, and risk-taking that are needed in today's complex and dynamic world. And I would assume Senator Riley could attest to that fact through his own experiences. But beyond the need to create the innovative thinkers that an arts-based education can provide, by the end of middle school, children need to have experienced an education that nurtures and develops their unique potential and their capacity for self-expression. They should have a rich background in academics and the arts, developing a deep sense of who they are and what they can do. Above all, they must have a love of learning and a self-confidence that will be the foundation for success and growth the rest of their lives. Research has shown that students who participate in the arts are more likely to become leaders and generally have higher levels of self-esteem, confidence, focus, self-discipline, productivity, tenacity, creative thinking, problem-solving, and communication. Being involved in the arts can also combat isolation and create a feeling of belonging for students who may need a place to feel supported. For some, the arts classroom experience is like finding a second home. For others, a reason to stay in school. Why do we need a task force? Who will fund it? Because we must answer the following questions. If the point of public education is to develop in students intelligence, a capacity for creative problem solving, and the capacity for communication, can an unenforced, unfunded, state-mandated arts education program that does not require localities to actually teach specific art forms or creativity training of any sort possibly get us there? Are we willing to look at creative funding models, such as Portland's arts tax, as well as guarantee funding for the arts in the state budget in order to create equal access to the arts across our state and to avoid urban areas having greater access to a creativity education than rural areas? If the goal of public education is to create wholly educated students, citizens, and workers, how can we best invest in an educational system that will recognize the value of teaching the creative processes that artists use to take an idea and make it real as a transferable method for discovering and possibly solving complex societal problems? Are we willing to reassess our entire approach to arts education by examining the status quo that rewards only students with perceived talent or an abiding interest in the arts, yet overlooks the responsibility we have to use the arts to prepare all students for the challenges in thinking and problem solving that lie ahead, while simultaneously providing every child with an avenue for healthy and creative self-expression? In closing, let me say that the greatest value in an arts education is found in creating a way of experiencing the world through our five senses, and offers the promise of rich and textured opportunities to learn about that world. This can foster in students both a love of knowledge and an unbridled enthusiasm for a chance to create innovative responses to both artistic and societal challenges in the innovation age. I hope you will take this opportunity for your committee to be innovative by creating a task force on equitable access to arts education through your work here at the legislature. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer.
You don't need to get that close to the microphone.
Am I back up about there? Is that good?
That's good.
Yay. Okay, for the record.
It tends to echo if you get too close.
Okay, thank you for your help. For the record, my name is Shelley Toon Lindberg. I am a 23-year resident of Hood River, Oregon. And if I may, I'm very pleased. Thank you. Chairman Beyer, if you could just thank Senator Thompson for his service to our community. So I'm here to speak about the work we do at Arts and Education of the Gorge. We're a 30-year nonprofit. We serve about 7,000 students per year in Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman County. In practical terms, the arts in our community work to educate students not just in the arts, but also in cross-curriculum. So one particular issue that is very real in the agricultural community I come from is the decline of the bees, and it poses an issue in agriculture and therefore for our economy, our rural economy. And so we received funding to have sculptors work closely with students at Y-East Middle School for over 18 months to develop pollinator habitats. They worked in the artist studios, they developed scale models, they helped fabricate actual habitats for bees. There are now 4 at Y-East Middle School and 2 at the Fish Food Bank in Hood River. That public funding, which came from the Oregon Arts Commission, leveraged more private funding from a foundation, and we're now building 15 more pollinator habitats in Hood River and Wasco County. So what does this do for students? How does it affect them? How does it affect our community and our economy? The students now have seen a pathway from where they are as middle school students working with professional artists, and might I say these are artists who are nationally known and who earn a very successful living as professionals. And those students see that you can actually have a livable and very comfortable wage as an artist. They've also helped to solve a problem that we're all dealing with in rural Oregon. And I can say that the community involvement has been substantial. So something that is really important is to remember the arts are not just a person alone in a room painting a beautiful painting. They can help us address contemporary issues that affect every single one of us. The chairs you sit in, the tapestries behind you, the car you drove here in, they were conceived of a person who learned design thinking. That's the work of arts education. It is what puts Oregon on the map. It is the national conversation right now is around creativity and the value of creativity in our education system. So to not have a task force would continue the trend that it shows that some schools who have more funding do have arts education, while those who do not have arts education. In our counties that we serve, we have 22,600 residents in Hood River County, 25,000 plus in Wasco, and 1,680 in Sherman County. So you can imagine Sherman County doesn't quite get the same attention to arts education as those in Hood River and Wasco. So how does that translate? If you're a student in a school in Hood River County, you have access to advanced placement classes in 2D and 3D art. So if you want to attend a top-tier college, Rhode Island School of Design, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, Pratt Institute, you have a much better chance of getting into that program. Unlike a student at Sherman County who does not have a visual arts specialist to help them in that endeavor. So I hope you'll consider forming a task force. It will be of great value to the students and to the communities we serve and also to the economy in Oregon. Thanks very much, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I really like this idea. I also hear a couple of people talking about some public-private partnerships that seem to have worked really well, and I'd like to see more of that around the state. Personal story, my stepson was not doing terribly well in high school until he got the chance to go to Jumpstart at Oregon State, which is their out of school program for artists, and was invited back again a year later. And this during that 1 year, his grades went up like 100%, because he had something he wanted to do. He wanted to go to Oregon State and be in a design major, which he did and graduated in design. So, and he's now working in the field. So, these are all good things. And I'd love to see something happening across the state. I'm not sure this is it, because we are, as you well know, very short on money, and task forces are expensive. So maybe we want to look at another way to go. I'm hoping we can do this, but I'm not sure that we can.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see, that's all I have signed up on Senate Bill 313. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, we don't have the paperwork today, so we'll close on this one and roll it over. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1051. Patrick?
Oh, I think, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1051 is going to sound familiar. It's because we heard a bill almost identical to this previously in the form of Senate Bill 470. That's what Senator Boquist is here. That was his bill also, so I will defer to Senator Boquist to talk about the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12, for the record. The reason 1051 looks like 470 is the only thing that's different is the relating clause, because the relating clause on 470 was screwed up by legislative council, the third this year for my time go around. Since that time, the good representative to my left, of course he's not really to my left, but that's okay, has come up with a couple of slight unintended consequences that he wants to identify for the record and potentially correct in the House of Representatives if the bill goes across there, which we are fine with. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative, because we're supposed to get you back on track, according to Patrick.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Rich Vile, House District 26 representative. And my law firm, the law firm that I formerly was a member of, has about 15,000 condominium and homeowner associations in the state of Oregon as clients. Some of those folks have brought to my attention that if this bill were to pass, all portions of the declaration, bylaws, governing documents might be abrogated. And, for example, even though Senator Boquist's situation is frankly a very compelling situation and should be addressed, and therefore we support this bill, we do not want to have the situation where an HOA can't enforce its parking restrictions, restrictions regarding the use of the common facilities, noise, et cetera. And so we're committed to working on a set of amendments that we can deal with over in the House, and in the meantime, we support the good senator's efforts here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Seeing none.
You're back on
Let's
track.
Go back to work. And Tracy Lang and Eva.
Move this bill today, so
we can.
Yes. Do that.
Thank you.
Please, welcome again. Yeah,
thank you very much. Nice to see you again. For the record, Tracy Lang from Philomath, Oregon, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee, just want to thank you again for considering this bill, as we'd heard from the two gentlemen before us. Your support in this matter is really greatly appreciated, and I believe that we'll move forward in a way that benefits all Oregonians, workers, and the development of children, actually, as we've heard in previous testimony this afternoon.
You see how little things like that, like we were talking about before.
Yeah,
trying
absolutely.
To fix something, all of a sudden you've undone all of the declarations and all of them. We'll fix that, though.
We'll fix that, and it is better, actually, now. Based on the feedback that we got, we did that amendment and rewrote the relating clause. So
great.
It's much better than it was before.
Thank you, and thanks for being patient with us. Eva.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. Eva Ripito, Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We're supportive of SB 1051 and appreciate your work and Senator Boquist's work, as well as Mr. Lang bringing it forward under his unfortunate circumstance. We found that other providers have met similar obstacles in running childcare in their communities. We know that just in a really brief check-in with some providers, we had three providers tell us that they had to shut down or sell and move their programs, sell their homes and move their programs because of HOAs. This, you know, when we're already challenged with finding childcare, this is one solution to help make sure that families have access to childcare in the communities where they live. And so we really do appreciate that your work, everybody's work on this. I provided written testimony that included some of the rules that are regulated and certified child care providers have to follow. I think they address some of the concerns that were brought forth under SB 470. So if you have any questions, I'm not an expert in the rules, but I can quickly look at them or refer to my written testimony.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you much.
Thank you very much.
And that's all that I had. Did you have a question?
I have a question for you.
For me, just a second. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 1051? Is it okay to close public hearing?
Yeah.
We'll close public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1051. And
well, the question I had, have we taken care of all the problems? It doesn't sound like we had, and maybe we need another amendment.
This is one of those times in the session where we're going to say, we're going to fix it in the House.
That's an oxymoron.
We're going to try. You going to take a shot at it?
Chair Beyer, Senator Rod, there is a House version of the bill as well, and I have spoken with Representative Vial, and there is an amendment request already put in for the House version of the bill as well that addresses his concerns. So yeah. Work is being done.
My understanding is it was just a technical language issue to make sure that we didn't somehow void all of the HOAs in the state. And since he's got, according to him, he has most of them in his law firm, perhaps that'll work out. We'll try. All righty. We're in work session, so the chair moves Senate Bill 1051 to the floor, I think, with a due pass. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator?
Yeah, there's a shortage of child care in our state, a significant shortage. My wife was a child care director for 20 years. She knows a lot more about it than I do. There are regulations, significant regulations. We need a wide variety of child care offerings from family child care in the house to Head Start to whatever it be. So I'm going to have faith that you, Mr. Chair, will work with the House and make sure that this meets everybody's intention, which is to provide additional, more child care availability to the residents of this state.
Thank you, Senator. Anybody else? No other discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? There appears to be none. So Senate Bill 1051 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation by unanimous vote of the committee. Senator Thompson is excused.
Senator Boquist will have him carry.
And Senator Boquist will carry. So we'll close on that. And let's see, now we're down to a bunch of work session stuff here.
We can just do these in order.
333.
Well, first we're going to move, we have to move a couple of these bills. So we will open a work session on Senate Bill 918.
Oh, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And this is a bill that we're moving over to the Joint Committee on Transportation and Modern. Okay, how do we do this?
You're being optimistic.
Okay, the chair moves Senate Bill 918 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and recommend that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Transportation, Preservation, and Modernization. Any discussion on that motion? Any opposition to that motion? It's passed. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 19 and 919.
Yes, thank you.
919. Senate Bill 919. And the chair moves Senate Bill 919 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and recommend that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition? These are called placeholders. And is there any opposition? I ask that. There is none. It is passed. And we're closed on that. And now we'll move on to
333.
We'll do a work session on Senate Bill 333. Patrick?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 333, we heard back on March 27th, this is the measure that removes the loan for forgiveness and reimbursement delays, makes up the changes to the Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program. The measure, as written, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. We have received, it was discussed at the hearing when we heard it, the Dash 4 Amendment. The Dash 4 Amendment makes some modifications to whereas clauses, modifies the definition of eligible employer to differentiate between urban and rural sites and to specify that the employer must already be conducting traded sector business. It modifies the definition of estimated incremental tax revenues. It adds the definition for rural site and urban site. It restores the definition of wage and restores references to estimated incremental income tax revenues. The amendment also directs Oregon Business Development Department to obtain from the Oregon Employment Department employment and wage information by April 1st every tax year. Following the first tax year, an employee of an eligible employer will be required to pay income taxes. The measure delegates duties to the Department of Administrative Services regarding wage and hour data to the Oregon Business Development Department. Mr. Chair, we have received a request from the Senate President that we add a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means with this measure. And to that end, we have received fiscal and revenue light statements. Those are statements that are essentially hall passes to allow us to move it to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
All righty. So we need to adopt the Dash 4 first, right? Mm-hmm. So the Chair moves the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 333. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the Dash 4 is adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 333 as amended by the Dash 4 to the floor with a due pass with subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. A discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Okay, that has passed, and we're done with that one. So what's up next here? Senate Bill
374.
334. So we will open a work session on Senate Bill.
We're actually going to carry over 374, Mr. Chair. We don't have.
Oh, we did carry that one over, didn't we? It was right there. I said that. No, we didn't.
Well, this one we're going to carry over as well, Mr. Chair. We're waiting for the fiscal and revenue impact statements.
All righty. So we will close the work session and carry that bill over. And so we're good on 664.
Oh, that's the next one. 664 is the one we're going to do.
We're going to do that.
Yes.
We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 664. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 664 prohibits state agencies from imposing civil penalties on small businesses for the first violation of paperwork requirements if the violation does not pose an unreasonable risk of harm to either the employee or the business or the general public. When we heard this last, we discussed an amendment. We have since received, had a little bit of discussion, and have now settled on a Dash 4 amendment. The Dash 4 amendment deletes the word inadvertent in language prohibiting imposition of civil penalty and specifies specific violations for which the prohibition applies. It specifies that the small business must be in substantial compliance with all other applicable laws. The failure must be the first violation, and the omission did not pose risk of harm to the employee or member of the public for prohibition to apply. And it provides that the prohibition does not apply when a contrary requirement is imposed by federal law or mandatory federal guidance. Mr. Chair, if I may, there was a small work group that helped develop this. Lindsay Baker from DAS is here and can testify if the committee has any questions about that. But generally, we have this is an amendment that has general agreement, I believe.
Thanks for working it out. Lindsay, we're all okay on this now?
That's my understanding.
That's right.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, Lindsay Baker with the Department of Administrative Services. As staff indicated, this was heard before your committee. Gosh, it had to have been about a month ago. And after that, we had a small group of stakeholders. There was myself, a few executive branch agencies, and then the home builders and Farm Bureau and NFIB. We had a pretty quick one and a half hour meeting and got to conceptually the amendments that are in front of you. We had a couple back and forth with legislative council, but it really was our attempt to acknowledge the problem as it was presented in the introduced version, really narrow the, not the scope, but the definition, make it a little bit clearer what it is that we're talking about when we talk about paperwork violations, and give agencies sort of that not really flexibility, but allowing us to continue to implement our federally delegated program. So my understanding is that stakeholders are okay with the Dash 4 amendments that are before you. I have not heard anything to the contrary, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Lindsay?
Seeing none. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Senator?
Move them.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 664.
Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 664. Discussion on the motion. Any opposition to the motion? Dash 4 is adopted. To the floor.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 664 with the Dash 4 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson's moved Senate Bill 664 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Senator Riley.
So I'd like to co-carry this with Senator Olson, if I may.
All right. Anything else? Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 664 is amended by the Dash 4 is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation by unanimous vote of the committee. Senator Olson and Senator Riley will co-carry. You guys can work out who opens and closes. So we'll close on that. And we go to 778.
753. Mr. Chair, if we would like, if you'd like, we could just note that 753 is not moving forward, Mr. Chair.
I thought I did that already.
Oh, you may have done that already.
But for the record, we are not moving 753. We will be moving, I think it's Senate Bill 983 in a moment. But we're right now, we're opening a work session on Senate Bill 778. Patrick.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 778, we heard way back on March 8th, a little over a month ago. This bill requires the Department of Transportation to pay just compensation for outdoor advertising signs that are removed, block damage, destroyed, or lost as a result of highway construction. It defines just compensation for purposes of the measure, directs the department to design work on highways so as to protect outdoor advertising signs for being from being blocked, damaged, destroyed, or lost as a result of construction. We have in hand a Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that provisions apply only to signs that are impacted by a project lawfully erected and in compliance with RS 377.700-844. With the Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair, the measure has a fiscal statement issued. The fiscal statement is available in your packets. It is indeterminate, so it does not require a ways and means referral. It also has no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sir, Dash 1s.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill or the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 778.
Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 778. Discussion on the motion. Any opposition to the motion? Dash 1s are adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 778 with a Dash 1 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 778 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Monroe.
I'm in opposition.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Senate Bill 778, as amended by the Dash 1s, is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Monroe is opposed. And let's see, Carrier, I'll go ahead and carry that. So we'll close on that. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 838. 838 timeshares.
Oh, 782. Do we do this 782, Mr. Chair?
Seven what?
782.
782.
Oh, didn't we just do that?
No, we just.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we'll go back to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's fine. We can do 838.
We already got 838. Absolutely. We'll do that.
Of course, Mr. Chair. So Senate Bill 838, Mr. Chair, excludes persons who are not developers of timeshares from compliance requirements for provisions governing timeshares. We discussed this bill back on March 22nd. The measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and does not have subsequent referral, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 838 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 838 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. Senate Bill 838 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass, and Senator Knope will carry that. We'll close on that, and we'll move back and open a work session on Senate Bill 782. Patrick.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 782 directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules that specify that a manufacturer's certificate of ownership or a manufacturer's bill of sale is valid evidence that the person owns a vehicle. I believe we have the parties to the bill who are going to come up to the witness table, Mr. Chair, and explain how this is all going to be resolved.
All righty. Amy and Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
You fixed it already?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and yes, I believe we've resolved it without needing a bill.
Linda Gardner, representing Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and yes, I agree with that. Amy's going to describe it to you.
So we don't need a bill?
We don't need a bill.
There we go. Thank you very much. We will close on Senate Bill 782.
She was going to describe it to you.
Do I need a description?
No.
You fixed it. If you fixed it, I don't need a description.
We just don't have time today.
We're moving.
If we don't need to do anything, why do we need a description?
That's right.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 930. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 930, we heard on March 27th as well, it allows registered vehicle owners to black out or obscure the residence address, business address, mailing address, or vehicle address shown on a registration card and on proof of insurance or other current proof of compliance documents. We heard this. I don't believe there was opposition when we heard this bill, Mr. Chair.
I don't think so.
Nobody testified in opposition. At least the measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. Senator Przanski was here to testify on it when we heard it. And that's where we are right now, Mr. Chair.
This is the Sharpie bill.
Sure. Yeah. I have a question.
Yeah.
If we can block it out, what do we need the information on it in the first place for?
Good question.
We had that discussion.
We did.
And it had to do with it needs to be on the record so that the police, when they pull it up on their screen.
No, but that's if they have your name.
You want to know?
Yeah.
Amy, reminder time.
She didn't get to talk on the last bill.
That's right.
Amy. We'll give you a chance.
Give her a reason to be here.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, thank you so much. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Right. So the reason that the bill doesn't just pull the address off of that document is, as with many things with the DMV, it would be kind of expensive programming. So the solution that Senator Przanski had was to allow folks to black it out.
So when we get a new computer system, you'll do this automatically?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, we'd certainly have the capability. Yeah.
When we get that new system, you guys will be able to fix these things?
We'll be able to do lots of things, we hope.
2030?
So. No. That's faster than
Senator Riley, we're counting on you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you. Any opposition?
We haven't had a motion.
You haven't even opened it.
You didn't have a motion, Mr. Chair. So
need a motion.
We were getting ready for that.
Yes, we were.
Go for it.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 930 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 930 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none. Senate Bill 930 is moved to the Senate bill with a do-pass recommendation by a unanimous decision of the commission. Senator Przanski will carry. We'll close on that. We'll open on Senate Bill 983. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 983 eliminates the limited maintenance electrician's license category and it eliminates the license requirement for making electrical installations or repairs on recreational vehicles as defined in electrical and elevator board rule. It also eliminates the license requirement for making plumbing installations or repairs on recreational vehicles as defined by state plumbing board rule. The measure has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. As written, Mr. Chair, we have no amendments, and the measure does not have a subsequent referral.
Mr. Long, I just want to get on the record here. I understand we had a lot of discussion during the hearing about RVs and park models, and we had problems with the park models, but I understand you have reached an accommodation with the manufacturers on how you will try to help them comply?
Mr. Chair, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes, for the record, we fixed it.
Let's go into a little more detail on this one.
Two bills ago, Mr. Chair. I just thought I'd try.
Yeah, I know.
All kidding aside, we've worked with the proponents of a previous bill that should you give us authority to do the rulemaking, and we get all the way through the process, working with our boards, we'll do rulemaking to provide relief to our HUD factories for a couple of years so they can set up their programs, their green programs.
Okay, so that worked. Okay. Jenna, did you want to comment at all?
She gave a thumbs up.
Don't say we fixed it.
Yeah. She's got the clients who may not be happy.
Mr. Chair, Genoa Ingram, Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, we just want to thank the building codes and Mark for working with us. We understand that there will be rulemaking that will enable us to carry on as we currently are for two more years, and he's offered to provide that language to us before this bill goes to the House. And we, again, want to thank him for his help and you and everyone else on the committee. Mm.
Senator?
So did we come to an agreement on the definition? My understanding was it was a manufactured house versus park model RV. So did we? Because I'm kind of curious how you would define that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, no, not yet, because it's really difficult. What we think we can do is tell what I call a traditional RV, and you remember my slides from before? So I think we're in really good shape on this product. I'm holding it up for everybody to see it.
That's easy.
Okay, yeah. That's the easy part. I want to get that off the table.
Yeah.
What we're going to do for these products, which are the park model RVs, since we're not having to deal with codes and standards and those other things, we're just dealing with licensing, we think we can create a narrow reference to the HUD factory and treat the factory as a whole versus the individual product. That's how we think we're going to solve the problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, Mark is absolutely correct, of course, and they would just be grandfathered in the current plants.
Yep. Follow up. My concern is you also showed some that went from that to an actual residential dwelling. It looked like it was on, a fixed foundation. So that's what obviously we don't want that. So. And like I said, the definitions are key, and what happens if they do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, again, what we're talking about, it gets down in the weeds a little bit. What we're talking about is a system to where, again, the regular traditional RVs off the table. Everybody else is going to be in the system because they are there today. We've got to remember the current law puts everybody in, whether you call it an RV, whether you call it a park model, whether you do it on wheels, whether you do it on foundations. You're in the soup right now. So what we're talking about is how to do exemptions. So we're going to carve out the regular RVs, the traditional RVs, and we're going to carve out the products that are in the HUD factories. Everybody else will still be in the licensing structure, whether you're on the foundation or not. And we're trying to avoid going down the rabbit hole that's been elusive for all of us and trying to figure out what you call all these individual different products. But we're going to deal with HERF factories as a whole because they do park models and they do HUD products right now under the federal standards.
Yeah.
Sorry for a long-winded response.
No, that's okay.
That's where we're at.
Mark, we're only one of two states that actually licenses or tags these or approves these in some way. And I know when we did it originally, my understanding is we did it sort of as a protectionist to Oregon manufacturers. Should we get out of the business?
Mr. Chair, so related to the inspection side, which is I think what you're referring to, I'm happy to consider that. Again, we're trying to
focus our efforts at building codes on the things where we provide the greatest value. And if we weren't inspecting traditional RVs, I'm happy that that would be an outcome. We don't have a bill in play. We can talk about it during the interim if you'd like. Remember, this is licensing, though. So licensing is a completely fundamental thing. And what I've tried to explain to folks, not very effectively, is you could, in theory, there could be no code requirement, there could be no inspection requirement, but still a need to do licensure. I can give you some examples off the top of my head, but they'd be good. In the plumbing electrical world, there are some things that are exempt from permit because it's repair and replace. But if you're in a commercial setting, you're going to use a licensed electrician. Does that make sense? So, and agricultural setting, since I'm looking at our friend over here, agricultural buildings are exempt from a building permit, but you still have to get an electrical and plumbing person to put the wiring and plumbing in, correct? So it gets a little complicated on the licensing side.
Yeah.
But on the code side, happy to work with you.
We happy now?
We're happy, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Relatively happy.
We're as happy as we can be, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, this whole thing has got to be a bit of a nightmare.
I tried. Alrighty. I tried with just we fixed it, but it didn't work.
Yes, you did.
You ready?
Yeah, we're ready.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 983 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 983 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 983 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Did you want to carry this one?
Yeah,
Thompson will carry. Closed on that, and I think we're done.
What?
Except for, for the record, we will be carrying over Senate Bill 313, Senate Bill 374, Senate Bill 538, and Senate Bill 1044 to Wednesday. Anything else for the good of the order? We're done.